This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to my debut episode on New Books Network. I'm your host, Ibrahim Fauzi, an academic and literary translator. And today, I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Denise to talk about her book, Narratives of Mistranslation, Fictional Translators in Latin American Literature. Welcome to the show, Dr. Denise.
Thank you so much. It's really good to be here.
Yeah, we're so glad to have you with us today. Before we dive into your book, could you share a little bit about yourself with our listeners?
Yeah, I'm Denise Kripper. I'm a literary translator. I am also associate professor of Spanish and Latin American literature and translation studies. And I am the author of this book we're going to be talking about, Narratives of Mistranslation, Fictional Translators in Latin American Literature. And finally, I'm also translation editor at the online magazine Latin American Literature Today.
Yeah, that's great. I'd like to start with the genesis of the book. What inspired you to delve into the world of fictional translators in Latin American literature?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Argentina. I was born and raised in Buenos Aires, and that's where I also studied translation. We have translation training programs there, so I was trained as a professional translator and worked as a literary and commercial translator for many years. And I was just very intrigued by the depiction of translators in literature. I liked seeing how my daily life, how my job had been represented in fiction. But it wasn't until much later that I actually found these novels and short stories that featured translators and interpreters as characters. I was actually in grad school when I first encountered one novel that had a translator character. And it seemed very fresh and new, and I was surprised by the depiction of a literary translator in the novel. It was not what I would have expected. It was not what I had, been trained to do necessarily. So I started wondering if there would be more novels, and it happened that it started as a hobby, sort of collecting these books. Every time I met a new person, a friend, bookseller, librarian, I would ask them, like, do you know any books with translators or interpreters as characters? And little by little, I started collecting them, and I ended up with a huge corpus. And they were fun. They were intriguing. They had a lot to say about translation. And it really challenged the way that I had perceived my job as a translator. So I really enjoy that. They're very unexpected in many ways, especially for someone who had been working as a professional translator. And so that's sort of how I started thinking about them. One of the things that intrigued me the most was that in most cases, translators were depicted as unfaithful, as treacherous, as double agents. And in many ways, that sort of responded to, you know, certain misconceptions or certain stereotypes around what translators do. But one of the curious things was that in most cases, the authors writing these books and these novels and short stories, they were translators themselves, or they had, you know, ample experience with translation themselves. So they knew exactly what they were doing, in the way that they were depicting the translator's task. And so it really became like a pressing question for me. Why are these all translators translating so poorly and more importantly, doing it on purpose, right? So yeah. This is not that they were translating badly because they didn't know the language, or they didn't have time, they were struggling with a deadline, or they didn't have enough resources, right? So they were very purposefully using mistranslation in various ways. And so, you know, part of my book was trying to unpack that and to think about mistranslation as something productive in translation studies.
Yeah, that's perfect. And I'm really curious about your unique approach to representing translation within the text. Can you tell us more about the decision behind embedding untranslated quotes and providing English translations? How do you feel this enhances the reader's understanding of the translation? Because me as a literary translator, I really enjoyed this part of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that comes from reading lots of translation studies books. And it's sort of like a pet peeve of mine. Sometimes people will quote from translations without acknowledging that they're quoting from a translation. So they will say something like, you know, Walter Benjamin said this, and then the quote would be in English. And, you know, Benjamin did not write in English, right? Or Schleiermacher said this about translation. And, well, he didn't use those words, like he was not writing in English, right? And so I figured that, you know, as a scholar of translation, I need to be very mindful in how I was using translations. I think that's very important for my work also as an educator. Like, I want students to know when they're reading a translation. I think, you know, translators' names deserve to be on covers, on the covers of the books that they translate, in bibliographies, in all reading materials. So I really wanted to visualize translation, and especially in a book like mine, where I'm using primary sources as, you know, case studies, and mostly they come from Latin American literature. And some of them have been translated into English, but most of them haven't. And so I really wanted to showcase that as well. I wanted Spanish to have a prominent place on the page. I wanted my readers to remember that these are books that have not been translated. I wanted them to be aware of all the richness that's out there that's not available in English. So, you know, when I'm using a source that has been translated into English, I want that translator to appear prominently on my page as well. So I will quote directly from their version, no problem. Of course, always acknowledging that that's their work. I want the mediation of translation to be visible. But whenever I was using either a primary source or a scholarly work that was originally produced in Spanish, I really wanted to keep that Spanish there. And then in between square brackets, I added my own translation. So that is a way of sort of reminding my readers that that is material that I'm bringing into translation for them, and that, you know, those texts are not readily available for everyone to just go and check them out in English. So there's so much, especially scholarly work being done in Latin America that hardly ever enters sort of the conversation in the Anglo world because it's being produced in Spanish or in Portuguese or in whatever language. So I thought that, you know, even though, you know, it might interrupt the reading, or, you know, all of a sudden, if you're not a Spanish reader, you might be sort of, you know, stopped or paused by those quotes in Spanish, and then you get to read the translation. I thought, you know, in a translation book, in a book that's about translation, it was so important for me to make translators' work and the work of translation visible in the page.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Yeah, really. Your book delves into various short stories in its first chapter. How do these narratives serve as gateways into the study of translation? And what insights can readers gain from analyzing these fictional texts?
Yeah, so my first chapter, it deals with three short stories that, in the way that I present the information in my book, they sort of act as prequels, right, or antecedents to what has become truly a phenomenon right now of translation narratives, or transfiction, as it's called in translation studies, or the fictional turn of translation studies, right? And that means that in the last few decades, there has been an upsurge in the publication of books that sort of, have translators or interpreters as characters, or that deal with translation. And that happens in Spanish, in Latin America, and also in other languages and other cultural traditions as well, right? But the interesting thing about the three short stories that sort of introduce my text and make part of the first chapter is that they predate all this. So this phenomenon of the fictional turn, I would say, is, turn of the century, or 1990s, the new millennium sort of approach to translation and globalization, and that makes perfect sense. But then we have earlier stories in Argentina, especially by Jorge Luis Borges, by Rodolfo Walsh, and by Julio Cortázar, that predate all this. And in many cases, they even predate, translation theories, right? So, some of the things that we now assume are part of the sort of translation studies canon, you can actually find those things in, earlier texts by Jorge Luis Borges, right? And what's so interesting to me about that is that in many ways they were doing translation theory in fiction, right? So the three short stories that I introduce in the first chapter are, of course, Pierre Bernard, author of The Quixote by Jorge Luis Borges, Nota al Pie, or Footnote, by Rodolfo Walsh, but this is one of the stories that has not been translated into English, and then Diary for a Story by Julio Cortázar. And so they're doing different things in sort of modeling how the representation of translation was going to be like afterwards in the Argentinian tradition, introducing ways of thinking of translation as something that is akin to writing, right? That it's not something that is secondary, that it produces original work. It sort of challenges the idea that translation has to be mimetic, for instance. So doing a lot of work in terms of translation theory from fiction, right, in short stories, and I think that's very key to the some of the concepts that I introduce in my book, because I want to use my book in pedagogical ways too, and I think that fiction, these narratives, introducing short stories or novels in the translation classroom, whether it's a theoretical seminar or a hands-on translation workshop, I think it's very useful in having students approach texts in a different way. And so I find these stories and the others that I use in my book too, to be a great resource for that.
Yeah, great. I will move directly to the second chapter, or chapter two. Chapter two examines historical Latin American narratives featuring language mediators as protagonists. Could you elaborate on recording history and writing literature?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the second chapter, what I try to do was sort of set up a chronology of like important moments for translation in the Latin American tradition. But of course, this is a totally fictional timeline. This is a timeline sort of created using novels and short stories that were written in the present time, right? They are not from those times, but they revisit those times. So The Two Shores by Carlos Fuentes is a short story from the 1990s that is actually set during the Spanish conquest of the Americas, and it features an interpreter as a character. El Intérprete, or The Interpreter, by Néstor Ponce is a novel, again, written in the 2000s, that goes back and explores 19th century independence in Argentina through the eyes of an interpreter. And then lastly, The Garden Next Door by José Donoso, again, written in the late 90s, is a novel that explores sort of the 60s and 70s in Latin American literature, right? So I was really interested in this sort of dislocation, temporal dislocation from the moment when these novels and short stories were written to the times that they're set in. And what I was trying to do with this chapter it sort of create, again, because of all these narratives are focused on characters that were largely marginal during these times, right? What I wanted to do was sort of create a narrative of the history of Latin America through translation, starting with these characters. So if we think about the Spanish conquest, for instance, we don't have chronicles by interpreters, right? So La Malinche, this like infamous interpreter for Cortés in the conquest of Mexico, right? We don't hear from her in the first person. The only information we have is through someone who was there, who wrote a little bit about her. And so they were largely invisibilized characters. We don't know much about them. The same truly about maybe translators during the sort of Wars of Independence, or, you know, we know that a lot of politicians at the time were translating, you know, politics documents and historical documents from France, for instance, right, in trying to sort of break free from Spain and their colonial power. But again, we don't have much historical records of all these translators. And in the case of the 1960s and 1970s, this is a time that we usually refer to as the boom of Latin American literature, because this is the time where a lot of writers from the region became very successful abroad, very successful in translation. And so I really wanted to sort of see the phenomenon through the eyes of a translator. And that I can do thanks to fiction, thanks to these narratives of mistranslation, as I call them, right? And so it really allowed me to retrace Latin American history through characters that were not protagonists at those times. But these are times that have been sort of highly influential in terms of defining Latin American identity and defining Latin American identity through translation. I cannot emphasize enough how important and foundational translation is for this region. And so I think this really sort of shines through in these three narratives, right?
Yeah. Now I feel that I have to reread the book after this conversation. Wonderful. I find the concept of using mistranslation as a tool of resistance quite intriguing. How do the fictional translators you studied in chapter 3 employ mistranslation to challenge exploitative industries?
Yeah. So my next chapter is all about the market of publishing and the market of, you know, the circulation of translations. And I take a look at two novels in this chapter, very different novels that were written sort of at the same time, both by Argentinian authors, and that really take a look at what was happening in Argentina in the 1990s. Especially in everything that has to do with the publishing market. And what I liked about this pair of novels, right? El Traductor, The Translator by Salvador Benedra, and El Testamento de Ojaral, or Ojaral's Will by Marcelo Cohen. And this is interesting because it's two novels that are not available in English translation. And I really feel like, you know, they should be widely read by people everywhere. And so so they're very different novels. The one by Salvador Benedra, I would say, is a very realist novel. It's very long. It has like excruciating detail about like the politics of the 1990s in Argentina. And this is sort of like an in-house, like the last in-house translator working at a press. This is a time where all this like international conglomerates were sort of like destroying the publishing market in Argentina by, you know, buying and merging all the presses. And the other one, the novel by Marcelo Cohen, is very different. It sort of explores the same moment in time in Argentina, but this is a speculative fiction novel. So everything is sort of distorted. It feels like a nightmarish version of Buenos Aires, or, you know, it's very almost sci-fi looking, right? And the character is also a translator here, of course. And, you know, he's actually working for, I would say, an independent publishing house, but this is really a clandestine publishing house They operate very differently. They're very politically involved. They don't pay any copyrights, and they have a very, let's say, special approach to translation, right? In that they translate all these bestsellers, but they do damage to the text in a way that becomes very productive sort of for their political purposes. And this is where sort of the idea of translation as, or sorry, mistranslation as resistance plays in. So the way that I see these two novels, they're sort of like counterparts to each other. In the case of Salvador Benedra, sort of the last straw that breaks the camel's back is that they bring in this new young translator to replace this very experienced, knowledgeable guy. And, you know, she's going to be cheaper to keep around. She's, you know, dabbles in languages because she went to a bilingual school. And she makes all these like terrible mistakes because she's actually not well prepared to do the job. And sort of mistranslation here becomes sort of a byproduct of an industry that is slowly vanishing, right? And so you can see mistranslation here as something that is very problematic. Whilst in the other one, we take a look at the Marcelo Cohen's translator, hurting the original, you know, exerting violence on it. And so he, again, like he translates this like awful bestsellers that are everywhere. And he knows this is such cheap, bad literature that he's putting out there. And he almost feels guilty about it. And the way that mistranslation works here is that he tries to make the book even worse in Spanish when he translates that. He wants to, you know, exaggerate things and really stretch the plot of the book and really what he's trying to do. And he, you know, these novels are super explicit about what they're doing themselves. They devote pages and pages to discussing these things, right? He really wants readers to be aware of the poor quality of those books. He wants to wake up readers, like, this is crap, like, wake up, like, I'm gonna make you see having a horrible translation, you know, make you see how horrible this book truly is. And so we see someone who's sort of resistant sort of the English neo-imperial publishing practices, right? And, you know, they're very funny, like, you know, disaster ensues, and they're very politically committed. But I would say here is clear where, you know, how mistranslation can be sort of the bad consequences of bad market practices, or they can be sort of used on purpose to exert some power over the very same industry where these translators work.
Yeah, so interesting and exciting. What's happening in this novel? Really, really exciting. Chapter 4 focuses on the intersection of gender and translation. Can you shed light on how gender influences translation practices and the portrayal of women characters in Latin American literature?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have so like, you know, there's so many metaphors to refer to translation, right? And a lot of them are really gender coded. When we talk about mother tongue, that's already like a gendered construction of how we think of language, right? But in sort of thinking between the relationship between writing and translating as hierarchical, where, you know, the original is the strong or, you know, father, right? And then the translation is secondary to that. It's the sort of the weak counterparts, translation seen as something feminized. Those are all very present discourses in the practice of translation. And most of the books in my corpus have male translators or male interpreters, and I really wanted to explore what happens when you have women doing the same job. And one of the things that I found very interesting is that the way that they use mistranslation is very differently from their male counterparts. So in my fourth chapter, I explore two novels by two Argentinian Writers, Ambactus, Servidor by Nadia Volonté. Again, this has not been translated into English. And then Include Me Out by Maria Sonia Christophe, which came out in English a couple of years ago with Transit Books. And these are two women interpreters. And something really interesting happens is that in the depiction of that, they sort of both employ the same mistranslation approach, I would say, which is withholding translation. So this is very different. This is not sort of tampering with meanings or changing things or introducing miscommunication like we see in some of the other chapters. But what happens here is that they decide to withhold translation. And then you see what happens in a world that is devoid of that. And I think that these novels too were very much influenced by this translation studies currents that have focused on feminism. And feminism in translation is in and of itself a very interesting sort of field to explore. And I think you can see some of those strategies being applied in these novels, in the way that they sort of hijack communication and in the way that they, you know, sort of get themselves involved in some of the issues around faithfulness. So very different chapter, very different approaches, and still lots to do in regards to gender and translation, I think. I believe that, you know, especially interpretation, it's sort of very female oriented. Most interpretation practitioners are women. And these are things that are not necessarily being studied enough. And I think that we should be doing more in terms of gender and both translation and interpretation. And so this is my little contribution to that in thinking gender through novels that feature a woman interpreter.
Yeah, brilliant. Really brilliant. Your explorations of sort of translation novels sound fascinating. How do these novels contribute to discussions around the reception and circulation of translations in Latin American contemporary literature?
Yeah, so pseudo-translation, I think it's interesting because, you know, it's sort of this resource that plays around with the idea or like challenges the idea of original versus translation. These are books that will pretend in many ways to be translations. And this is by no means something new. We can even think about De Quixote, right? Which plays around with the same idea, De Quixote, you know, sort of being like a fake translation in many ways. And so I think that this is happening again in some of the contemporary novels that are, you know, by writers who are already thinking about being translated into another language and thinking through, you know, how this is going to be received or not in other places. And so the idea of pseudo-translation or the idea by Rebecca Walkowitz of, you know, born translated novels is very prominent in Latin American literature today. I'm sorry, Latin American literature, not today. That's the name of my magazine. and so I was very interested here in working with two novels, 2666 by Roberto Bolaño and Traveler of the Century by Andrés Neumann. And just as some anecdotal information, Traveler of the Century was actually that one first novel that I read back in grad school that had a translator protagonist, and that got me thinking about this project to begin with. So I wanted to give it a shout out because it, you know, it's a novel that sort of meant a lot to me in this process. And, you know, Traveler of the Century, for example, it's written by Andrés Neumann, who's an Argentinian author, although he has lived half of his life, at least in Spain. But this is a novel set in Germany. And so the characters you would think would be speaking in German, right? Because they're all German, they're in Germany, but the novel was written in Spanish. And if you read it in English translation, you know, you read it in English. So there's already like a translation process embedded in the reading practice, right? So you're reading in Spanish. So Spanish is the original language in which it was written, but you know that those characters are speaking German because they're German and they're in Germany, right? So there's already a translation process embedded there that I thought was interesting. And something similar happens with 2666, especially in the same in the first part. This is a very long book with several parts, but I'm focusing mostly on the first one, which features different translators. And one is Italian, one is French, one is English, one is Spanish. And they're all speaking amongst themselves, and you're never sure which language they're speaking in, but you're reading it in the Spanish original. Bolaño wrote it in, although you might be writing, reading it in English. So it's a great sort of puzzle of translation happening. And you know, this idea of challenging what is even an original, right? So let's say, if Andres Neumann's novel got translated into German, the characters would be speaking German, right, in that version. So is that more original than the original version in Spanish Neumann wrote? So again, all these games about sort of, challenging that hierarchy and playing around with these concepts, I thought were very sort of productive in sort of deprogramming how we think about all these categories and how they impact the way that we understand translation, we practice translation, we talk about translation. Lots of things happening in that last chapter.
Great. Let's move away from the book to, we have mentioned translators, the word translators a lot, and because I'm an emerging literary translator, for emerging literary translators out there, what advice would you offer based on your own experience in the field? I'm really thrilled to listen to what you will advise me and advise all the emerging literary translators listening to us today.
So I think the first and I would say perhaps even most important thing that you could do is find a community of people to surround yourself with and support and get supported by. I think it's commonplace to think about translation as a solitary activity, and it doesn't have to be, and it really shouldn't be. And I think translation is best practice when you do it as a community. So finding people that you can workshop translations with, finding readers for your translations, translations are nothing but an interpretation, a reading of a text, right? That you're just writing in another language. So having people to discuss those things and sort of assess your reading with, I think it's very important. I'm fortunate enough that I'm sort of a founding member of a translators collective back in Chicago where I live. It's called the Third Coast Translators Collective. And we don't even translate from the same language. Like, we have people translating from Bulgarian, Japanese, Arabic, French, Basque, Hindi. But we all translate into English. And so when we workshop, we really focus on the translation as its own piece of work, because in most cases we cannot access the source language, right? And so the workshops with them have been so productive in better understanding what I do as a translator, just by seeing how others translate. So that's so important. And I also have another group of friends with whom I workshop translations too from Spanish, and I value their insights so much. And so if you, for whatever reason, cannot find people who are interested in translation, or people who would be willing to workshop translations with you, I think reading translations is so important, right? Getting a taste for what other translators are doing. Hopefully those books might include translator's note or preface or footnotes or something that will sort of give you some insights as to what their process is like. And I think that's so important. And social media is also a great tool for that. So if you're on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, whatever, follow translators. They will most probably be talking and discussing translation in their feeds. So I highly encourage you just to you know, join the conversation, ask questions, and get to meet people like that.
Well, Dr. Denise, we have taken up a lot of your time. And my last question is, what are you working on now?
What am I working on now? Well, I'm sort of looking to my next project. I really, you know, of course, this book is an academic book. It's published by Routledge. It has a pedagogical component. So I'm hoping educators and students will implement it in their coursework. But I also want to talk about translation with a larger audience and with people who might not be experts on translation, who might not have any experience, either professional or theoretical, on translation. So I'm working on a book of essays about the craft of translation and how to think through translation in our daily lives.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Dr. Denise. It was lovely talking to you.
Thank you so much for your questions. I enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, we really enjoyed too. And thank you everyone for listening. Don't forget to share and recommend the show. Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.